Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Today is Monday. It's January 31st, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. Got a little house cleaning before we begin the broadcast. We normally speak to New York State Assembly member Nader Sayegh, who represents the 90th Assembly District, which is the entire area is all Yonkers, but it's only about 85% of Yonkers. Well, normally on Friday when we speak to him, he's not in session, but this particular Friday he was in session at the New York State Assembly. And then we had planned on Friday, instead of Friday, actually, we had intended that he would be on today's broadcast at 11:30. But unfortunately, he's still in session. So we expect him to be in session all the way through Wednesday. So Friday he was in session, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday are coming up next. Already Monday's here. So we won't be able to speak to him today. We're going to begin the show, of course, with White Plains Citizenet reporter, publisher, and editor John Bailey. We're going to talk to him about baseball. We're going to talk to him about police conduct. And also then we're going to speak at 10:30 with Michael Edelman, the national political analyst and pundit. And then we're going to speak to Ron Matten. Ron Matten's a Yonkers politician, and he wrote an article which was in our paper. Let me just quickly look. I don't remember what the date was. Bear with me a second as I pull this up. Okay, bear with me a moment here. Yeah, there was an article that was picked up by the Wall Street Journal, and the article was written by Ron Matten. And let me just quickly pull it up here. But it was picked up by James Hanley. Mr. Hanley is a wrote an opinion piece and a commentary in the Wall Street Journal. And he's also a senior policy analyst at the Empire Center. So his article was published online on the 30th of January in the Wall Street Journal, but appeared today in the physical paper of the Wall Street Journal. So we picked it up today, and we posted it, and we linked it to the article that was initially written by Mr. Matten on the 18th of January. And evidently, the article has taken off like wildfire. And then we also hear on top of that, there's a publication in Yonkers called the Yonkers Times, and they also wrote an article about it. I haven't read that yet. Very, very interesting that people have picked it up, and thankfully they picked it up with us and so on. But we're going to speak to none other than Ron Matten this morning at 11 o'clock. Okay, it looks like for some reason we're not getting through, or we haven't heard from John Bailey. So let me see if I can give him a call, and hopefully we'll be able to get him. Otherwise, if we can't, then we'll move on to some other issues that you might find interesting. Bear with me a moment. Okay. All right. So it looks like now we should be ringing, and hopefully we'll get him. We'll see what happens. Okay.
This is John Bailey, the CitizenNet reporter. Thanks for trying to get in touch with me. Please leave your message, and I'll be back in touch with you as soon as possible.
At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished...
Okay, we're going to disconnect. So evidently, for some reason or another, we can't get through, and or he's not available, or there's something wrong with the line. So we'll just move on. And we won't be able to speak to him then today. So let's quickly look at what was happening here. And that was want to read this to you. The title of the Mr. Hanley's article, which is, well, it's an opinion piece, is labeled as Yonkers, New York, Pulls a Green Energy Fast One on Residents, and it's written by James Hanley. So the first line is, congratulations, you've won a higher electric bill. So out of New York, we write based on today's date because it's in the print paper, ever get an offer in the mail that you felt was too good to be true? Well, residents of Yonkers, New York's third largest city, know just how you feel. Well, in early January, a letter arrived in Yonkers residents' mailboxes from an outfit called Sustainable Westchester. It could easily have been mistaken for junk were it not for the city's official seal in the lower right corner and a message in small print which quoted as saying, please do not discard official notification, end quote. Anyone who didn't toss the letter in the recycling bin got the following message, framed as unambiguously great news. Quote, the city is pleased to inform you that your household, .. will be automatically switched from the utility standard supply into the Westchester Power 100% renewable supply on your first meter read date after March 1st of 2022. Well, Publishers Clearinghouse couldn't have done better. The catch was buried deep in the fine print. Homeowners who don't opt out will see an average increase of nearly 19% in the price of electricity, making it more expensive to keep the lights on. This stealthy price hike, not to mention the sneaky packaging of the official notification, evidently comes with the endorsement of Mayor Mike Spano, a Democrat in his third term. If he thought his constituents would happily volunteer to pay more for electricity, he'd almost certainly have asked them to opt in to this green scheme. It's likelier that he's thinking of running for governor someday and looking for ways to demonstrate his environmentalist bona fides to progressive New York State Democrats. Well, during a decade in City Hall, Mr. Spano has championed green programs like the Green City Leadership Awards and LED streetlights. The latter program shows that being green sometimes pays well, as less energy-intensive street lighting saves the city around $1.8 million per year. But unlike the streetlights program, Yonkers residents won't save with Westchester Power. Last year's average price for electricity was 7.3 cents a kilowatt hour. Renewable energy from Westchester Power will cost 8.7 cents. And those pennies add up. Mr. Spano has engineered a scheme to burnish his green credentials and make Yonkers residents pay for it. Using the opt-out program, opt-out approach, the city doesn't have to bother with persuasion. It can simply gouge those who don't carefully read every notice they receive from the government, an especially unfair approach to Yonkers' poorest residents, who already pay electricity rates more than 30% above the state average and almost twice the national average. According to the United States Census Bureau, the poverty rate in Yonkers is nearly twice that in the rest of Westchester County. Adding insult to injury, the national economy is experiencing the worst inflation in 40 years. Anyone who wants to pay more to go green should have the choice. In a properly functioning market, consumers express their preferences through the prices they pay. The opt-in approach places the decision squarely in the hands of the energy consumer. The sneaky opt-out technique ensures that some unwary customers will suffer sticker shock because they didn't read a letter from the city government. Just so you know, Mr. Hanley is a senior policy analyst at the Empire Center. This article appeared in the January 31st, 2022 print edition of the Wall Street Journal. And the issue came up originally on January 18th when it was published in the Yonkers Tribune. And it was then a title, Westchester Power and Community Choice Aggregation, written by Ron Matten. And interestingly enough, Ron Matten will be on our broadcast today And let me just see when he'll be on. He'll be on at 11 o'clock this morning, so we'll talk to him then. When Mr. Matten wrote the article, he had 37 comments posted to the article, which is really, really fascinating, of course. And there's already one comment in the Handley op-ed piece. Let me just quickly see where it is. Oh, and then somebody writes, it's just a prelude for more scams. They will see what kind of response it gets and plan for the next scam accordingly. Well, that's the opinion of one particular writer. We didn't post this until about, it was around 8:30 this morning, around that. No, sorry, it was at 8:10 this morning. So it's good to always check. Okay, so it looks like for whatever reason, John Bailey is not going to be able to join us. So let's move on before our 10:30 guest, which is Michael Edelman, and we'll speak to him. He's a national political analyst and pundit, so we're going to share his thoughts when he gets on the line. So let me quickly read this to you. Bear with me a moment here. All right, one second. What am I doing here? That's wrong. Okay. I think we got this now right. All right, let's just see if we got it all there. Okay, this is probably one of the most important issues that impacts everyone. Evidently, Russia and the United States are going to square off at a United Nations Security Council meeting today over Ukraine. The United States and Russia are squaring off at the United Nations Security Council over Ukraine, with Washington calling Moscow's actions a threat to international peace and security, while a Kremlin envoy ridiculed Monday's meeting as a PR stunt, quote unquote. The session kicks off more high-level diplomacy this week, although talks between the United States and Russia have so far failed to ease tensions in the crisis. Russia has massed an estimated 100,000 troops near Ukraine's border, stoking fears in the West of an invasion. Now, Russia denies it intends to launch an attack, but demanded that NATO promise never to allow Ukraine to join the alliance, halt the deployment of NATO weapons near Russian borders, and roll back its forces from Eastern Europe. NATO and the U.S. called those demands impossible. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and United States Secretary of State Antony Blinken didn't make any visible progress in easing the tensions at their meeting in Geneva earlier this month. They are expected to speak by phone on Tuesday, according to the Russian Foreign Ministry. U.S. President Joe Biden warned Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in a phone call on Thursday that there is a distinct possibility, quote unquote, Russia could begin an incursion in February, but the Ukrainian leader sought to play down the war fears, saying that Western alarm over an imminent invasion has prompted many investors in the country's financial markets to cash out. Zelensky said on Friday that, quote, we aren't seeing any escalation bigger than before, end quote, and charged that the Russian buildup could be an attempt by Moscow to exert, quote, psychological pressure, end quote, and sow panic. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson will visit Ukraine on Tuesday for talks with Zelensky, and will speak with Russian President Vladimir Putin later on Monday to urge him to, quote, step back, quote, unquote, Johnson's office had said. Well, Johnson says he's considering sending hundreds of British troops to NATO countries in the Baltic region as a show of strength. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said on Monday that, quote, hysteria promoted by Washington triggers hysteria in Ukraine, where people are almost starting to beg for the front line, end quote. While Russia could try to block the Security Council meeting if it gets the support of 9 of its 15 members, United States was confident it had, quote, more than sufficient support, end quote, to hold it, according to a senior official in the Biden administration who spoke on condition of anonymity because he was not authorized to talk publicly. Any formal action by the Security Council is extremely unlikely, given Russia's veto power and its ties with others on the Council, including China. Well, U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield said that Russia's actions pose, quote, a clear threat to international peace and security and the United Nations Charter. Speaking Sunday on ABC's This Week, Thomas-Greenfield said, quote, we're going into the room prepared to listen to them, but we're not going to be distracted by their propaganda, end quote. She said last week that council members, quote, must squarely examine the facts and consider what is at stake for Ukraine, for Russia, for Europe, and for the core obligations and principles of the international order should Russia further invade Ukraine, end quote. Now, Russia's Deputy United Nations Ambassador Dmitry Polyansky tweeted that he hoped other Security Council members, quote, will not support this clear public relations stunt, end quote. Assuming the meeting goes ahead, the Council will first hear a briefing by a senior United Nations official, followed by statements from its 15 members, including Russia, the United States, and European members France, Ireland, United Kingdom, and Albania. Under Council rules, Ukraine will also speak. China's United Nations Ambassador Zhang Jun indicated Beijing supports Moscow in opposing a Council meeting. Quote, both sides have shown willingness to continue their negotiations, end quote, he told several reporters on Friday. Let them settle the difference through dialogue, through negotiations, end quote. Quote, Russia has said clearly they have no intention to have war, end quote, and the Security Council should, quote, help to de-escalate the situation instead of adding fuel to the fire, Zhang had said. Well, Geraldine Byrne-Nassen, Ireland's United Nations ambassador, said her country wants to see calm prevail. We want to see de-escalation, diplomacy, and dialogue, end quote, she added. On Sunday, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Bob Menendez, said that in the event of an attack, lawmakers want Russia to face, quote, the mother of all sanctions, end quote. That includes actions against Russian banks that could severely undermine the Russian economy and increased lethal aid to Ukraine's military. Sanctions under consideration would apparently be significantly stronger than those imposed after Russia annexed Crimea from Ukraine in 2014, and those penalties have been seen as ineffective. Menendez also raised the prospect of imposing some punishment preemptively before any invasion. Now, Vladimir Izakhenkov in Moscow and Jill Lawless in London contributed to this article, and this was posted by the Associated Press on the crisis in Ukraine. And so that was like the big issue there. Let me see if we can go back to our studio screen. Bear with me a moment here. 1 second. Okay, yeah, we still haven't heard from John Bailey, so it's already, we're 18 minutes into the broadcast, so I doubt very seriously that he'll be calling us. Okay, so let's look at some other issues. Bear with me a moment here. Okay, 1 second. All right, let me just move on here. Okay, bear with me a second. It sometimes takes a little bit of time to bring up all these articles. Okay. This is really quite interesting because it affects a lot of people. Bear with me a moment. In an exclusive written by Reuters, they write that United States diabetes deaths top 100,000 for the second straight year, written by Chad Terhune and Robin Respout. Well, more than 100,000 Americans died from diabetes in 2021, marking the second consecutive year for that grim milestone and spurring a call for federal mobilization similar to the fight against AIDS and HIV/AIDS. The new figures come as an expert panel urges Congress to overhaul diabetes care and prevention, including recommendations to move beyond a reliance on medical interventions alone. A report released earlier this month calls for far broader policy changes to stem the diabetes epidemic, such as promoting consumption of healthier foods, ensuring paid maternal leave from the workplace, levying taxes on sugary drinks, and expanding access to affordable housing, among other areas. In 2019, diabetes was the seventh leading cause of death in America and claimed more than 87,000 lives, reflecting a long-running failure to address the illness and leaving many more vulnerable when the COVID-19 pandemic hit, creating new hurdles to accessing care. And since then, the nation's toll from diabetes has increased sharply, surpassing 100,000 deaths in each of the last 2 years and representing a new record high level, according to a Reuters analysis of provisional death data compiled by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. Diabetes-related deaths surged 17% in 2020 and 15% in 2021, compared to the pandemic level in 2019. And that excluded deaths directly attributed to COVID-19. The CDC concurred with a Reuters analysis and said that additional deaths from 2021 are still being tallied. Now, the large number of diabetes deaths for a second year in a row is certainly a cause of alarm, said Dr. Paul Hsu, an epidemiologist at UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health. Quote, type 2 diabetes itself is relatively preventable. So, it's even more tragic that so many deaths are occurring, unquote. In a new report, the National Clinical Care Commission, created by Congress, said that the United States must adopt a more comprehensive approach to prevent more people from developing type 2 diabetes, the most common form, and to help people who are already diagnosed avoid life-threatening complications. About 37 million Americans, or 11% of the population, have diabetes, and 1 in 3 Americans will develop the chronic disease in their lifetime if current trends persist, according to the commission. Well, diabetes in the United States cannot simply be viewed as a medical or health care problem, but also must be addressed as a societal problem that cuts across many sectors, including food, housing, commerce, transportation, and the environment. End quote, the commission wrote in its January 5 report to Congress and the United States Department of Health and Human Services, which is the HHS. Well, the federal panel recommended Congress create an Office of National Diabetes Policy that would coordinate efforts across the government and oversee changes outside health policy. It would be separate from HHS and could be similar to the White House Office of National AIDS Policy, according to Dr. William Herman, Commission Chairman and a professor of internal medicine and epidemiology at the University of Michigan. We aren't going to cure the problem of diabetes in the United States with medical interventions, Herman told Reuters. The idea is to pull to get something together across federal agencies so they are systematically talking to one another, State Senator Patty Murray, a Democrat from Washington, who chairs the Senate Health Committee, helped create that commission in 2017 and said she's studying the recommendations closely. Quote, people with diabetes and other chronic illnesses were already facing challenges well before the pandemic hit, and COVID has only made these problems worse, Murray said in a statement to Reuters. It is absolutely crucial to research and find solutions to better support diabetes patients and get them the care they need. Well, there are more cases and worse prognoses. As Reuters reported last year in a series, diabetes represents a major public health failure in the United States. The number of Americans with the disease has exploded in recent decades, and their prognosis has worsened, even though spending on new treatments has soared. The pandemic has proven especially deadly for people with diabetes. People with poorly controlled diabetes have at least a twofold greater risk of death from COVID-19, according to the report. And diabetes and its complications are more common in low-income Americans and people of color, longstanding disparities that were further exposed during the pandemic. Dr. Shari Bolin, a commission member and an associate professor of medicine at Case Western Reserve University and the Metro Health System in Cleveland, said the staggering number of diabetes deaths is, quote, disheartening, but also a call to action, end quote. Now, the federal panel's report marked the first such review on diabetes since 1975, and during that time, the prevalence of diabetes among U.S. adults has increased from 5.3% in the late 1970s to 14.3% in 2018, it said. Direct medical costs related to diabetes were $237 billion in 2017, and there was an estimated $90 billion lost to lower productivity in the United States. High costs for doctor's visits, medications, and supplies forced many diabetes patients to forego or delay routine care. Many patients and U.S. lawmakers have expressed outrage at the rising price of insulin, which type 1 diabetes patients must take their entire lives and which is sometimes required to keep type patients' disease under control. The commission endorsed proposals such as capping insulin price increases to the rate of inflation and government negotiation of drug prices. Murray and other lawmakers have pushed for a provision in the Biden administration's proposed Build Back Better legislation that would cap the cost of insulin at $35 for many patients. To further ease financial barriers, the panel recommended that patients' out-of-pocket costs be waived for other high-value treatments, including certain diabetes drugs, continuous glucose monitors, basic supplies, and diabetes education. The commission also highlighted the risk of treatment, of overtreatment in older adults with type 2 diabetes. Reuters wrote about that risk in November and how a drug industry campaign for an aggressive treatment target led to an epidemic of potentially lethal incidents of low blood sugar or hypoglycemia. The panel asked federal health officials to track overtreatment among Medicare patients to reduce the incidence of severe hypoglycemia and improve patient safety. The commission said that the United States should better promote the purchase of fruits and vegetables and fruit in food assistance programs and ensure mothers have paid family leave to aid breastfeeding, which can help reduce the risk of diabetes in mothers and is associated with a reduced risk of obesity and diabetes in children. The panel also recommended imposing taxes on sugary drinks that would raise their shelf price by 10 to 20% and using the revenue to expand access to clean drinking water and fund similar programs. HHS deferred comment to Herman. In a statement, the CDC said that the report's recommendations offer a detailed roadmap to addressing rising health care costs attributed to diabetes and reducing racial, ethnic, and income-related disparities in diabetes outcome. This reporting was by Chad Terhune and Robert Respau, editing by Daniel Wallace and at the Thomson Reuters Trust. And so that was the story there. Okay, well, let's move on to our website. We should be getting a call momentarily. Bear with me a second here. Okay. All right, we should be getting a call very, very shortly from none other than, one second, where are we here? Yeah, we're going to be getting a call very shortly from Michael Edelman. He's a national political analyst and pundit. So what I want to do is let me go over to that site. Bear with me a second so I can prepare this. Bear with me a moment here. I don't have all my notes. There's so many pages that are open in order to keep all this in place. So we're going to get a call, not from Ron Matten, but rather from Michael Edelman, the national political analyst and pundit. So bear with me a moment as I try to pull this up, and then we'll be able to get started with Mr. Edelman when he calls up, which should be in about a minute's time. So So bear with me a second. Okay, we can get rid of this page because that's not pertinent for us anymore. And here we are on the task of the day. Okay, so I've got this in place. And let me go back to our studio screen, and there's Mr. Edelman. Good morning, Mr. Edelman. Good of you to call.
Good
How
morning,
are
Virgin.
You today?
Well,
I hear
Pretty
you're
good.
Freezing
you?
Down in Florida.
We are.
Are you freezing?
Yep.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I never heard of such numbers like that recently.
You know,
yesterday I looked at
that's
them.
At night. That's at night, though. In the day, it's still high 60s and 70s. The overnight temperatures down in the 30s.
Unbelievable. Yes. So you're challenging New York, you know, which is amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
we're waiting
what's
for
happening
those.
I hope not. Well, we are looking at your bailiwick, so to speak, the national political analysis that always is so good from you. Well, one of the things that really came up, which is really interesting, is that a majority of Americans who participated in a new poll want President Biden to consider all possible nominees following the president's commitment to nominate a black woman to the high court. Is this politics? And what's the best way? Should it be kept open? Should it matter if there's a black woman or a woman or a black man or a white man or some other color?
Saying Biden promised during the campaign to appoint a black woman. He was elected. Elections
Correct.
Have consequences.
Yes.
This is no different, as far as I'm concerned, than appointing somebody who is going to overturn Roe v. Wade. It's the same thing.
Right.
You have a goal, and you appoint somebody who's going to fulfill that goal. So Donald Trump had three appointments, and all three of them were right wingers.
Correct.
There's never been a black woman on the court, and black women are responsible for electing Joe Biden, and so there will be a qualified black Supreme Court justice. Even Lindsey Graham said that the woman that is sitting as a federal judge in his state, South Carolina, is perfectly qualified for the job. So you're going to see some Republicans vote for whomever Joe Biden picks.
Okay. Well, that's very encouraging because I concur with you. A black woman who could be a jurist, that would be phenomenal because we do need to lend a greater complexity that, in a sense, actually mimics the population. And I think people forget that at times.
The woman who is being considered from South Carolina is not somebody who has attended Harvard and Yale. It's somebody who went to a state school and you know, made her own name in law and was appointed to the bench. So that is a different perspective than most of the judges who are, you know, Harvard, Yale appointees.
Very well expressed. Well, there's some other issues as well because there's so much to cover, my God. Evidently, a Pentagon spokesman by the name of John Kirby on Sunday said that the U.S. is looking at deterrence against Russia's aggression toward Ukraine. And then Bob Menendez, the senator from New Jersey, and Jim Risch of Idaho, a Republican, the chairman and the top Republican on the Foreign Relations Committee, said that a joint interview with CNN's State of the Union, that's what they spoke about. Is America clear about what it wants to do there in Ukraine?
Yeah, I think so. I think both Republicans and Democrats. First of all, we're not sending troops to Ukraine. That's off the table.
Okay.
Second of all, it's very clear that Vladimir Putin wants to reestablish the old Soviet Union, and that he has designs on those countries that were breakaway countries after the wall came down. So Ukraine is a democracy. We're on the side of democracies, which apparently some Republicans are not on. It was very clear Tucker Carlson made a statement on Fox News that we shouldn't be helping Ukraine because it's somehow in Russia's sphere of influence. We really shouldn't care about Russia's sphere of influence. We should care about whether the countries are taking the democratic road or not, and Ukraine is. And so we're going to support them. So are the NATO nations. And
they
will receive but military. Right, the British, absolutely. They'll receive everything but troops. They'll receive weapons.
Mm-hmm.
They'll receive money. They'll receive, you know, other kinds of support. No troops. And then we'll see what happens, whether Putin backs down or not. If he doesn't back down, they're going to be sanctions imposed, quote unquote, like you've never seen before, unquote.
Yeah.
That will hurt Vladimir Putin and his oligarch friends.
Is it conceivable that if the repercussions come from the West against Russia, that it could undermine Putin's capacity to hold on to power, or is he so entrenched that he's going to be there no matter what? But he could certainly be weakened, wouldn't he?
Well, I mean, weakened is really not relevant. I don't think anything other than a military coup in Russia would remove him. I know he's got some issues, political issues. He's got Alexei Navalny, who is he's tried to kill three times. But I don't think people are in a revolutionary mood in Russia. So I think he's good for the long run there. But he really shouldn't push his luck, because if he gets embarrassed too many times, or if his oligarch friends, have sanctions imposed that are too draconian, they may say, hey, look, Vlad, knock it off.
Mm. Very well expressed. Well, I want to ask you about Senator Susan Collins, the Republican of Maine. On Sunday's ABC's This Week, she said, we're a long ways from 2024. But let me say this. I do not think that President Trump should have made the pledge to do pardons. We should let the judicial process proceed, she added, referring to Trump's suggestion during a Texas rally on Saturday that he would consider pardoning those charged in connection with the January 6th attack. That's almost outrageous when all the information hasn't come out. So why would the former president even suggest it? And Collins
because the people that because the people that attend his rallies are the base of the Republican Party. These are the QAnon people. These are the people that relish conspiracy theories. They think JFK Jr. was going to come back in Texas. These are nuts. And he knows he's going to get a rise out of them. But here's the thing. He needs to be careful from a political point of view. One by one, Republican politicians are making it clear that they don't support giving pardons to people who attempted a coup d'etat, and that includes Lindsey Graham, who said that, Susan from Maine, and people across the country who are now saying that the president's rhetoric is unacceptable. Governor Asa Hutchinson of Arkansas said, quote unquote, Trump should not be leading the Republican Party in the future. So you're seeing them, they're picking out a line in the sand, and they're distancing themselves from Donald Trump, and particularly over January 6th commission. We don't know what these people are going to say under oath, particularly those people who are inside the White House, who are C players, who want to preserve their option about working in Washington going forward. These are young people. They are not going to lie. They're going to tell what they saw and what Trump did. And what Trump did was to cheer on the Capitol marauders. He wanted them to overturn the government. They wanted Mike Pence to do something the Constitution doesn't support, and he's still going out on the rally mode and saying the same thing about the election being stolen. It was not stolen. Governor Sununu of Maine said it was not stolen. Let's move on. And that's what more and more these leading Republicans are saying. By the way, I believe the same poll you cited at the beginning of the program or another poll had 70% of Republicans saying they did not want Donald Trump running again.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So in a sense, well, what was very interesting is right after he was gone and Biden, you know, became the president, sworn in as president, there seemed to be a lot of support for him. And evidently he still was sucking up all the air and his rhetoric was strong.
Right.
But then the Democratic response was not very, very good because a lot of it was opinion driven rather than fact driven. But then I guess we didn't have all the facts at that time. Are we now at that turning point where the facts are starting to come out and the arguments being made against the former president are now more rational? And instead of emotional, this is what happened and this is it. Take it or leave it.
Well, some people
won't.
People are starting to see what exactly happened on January 6th as the testimony is revealed, which is the strategy of the January 6th committee, is the drip, drip, drip of disinformation over time. You know, one news story doesn't really make an impression on people because they're channel flipping or they're surfing or they're not paying attention. But if you've got the same story over and over and over and over again, eventually even Donald Trump supporters are going to hear what actually happened. And it's very interesting because recent polling also shows that Republicans, by a huge margin, now consider the party more important than Donald Trump, whereas immediately after the election or going into the 2020, they said Donald Trump was more important than the party. Now they're changing, totally reversing themselves. That's a huge development. That means
unbelievable. I didn't realize that. Yeah. But we don't know who the rising stars are yet.
Well,
I guess that will take time.
Well, it's DeSantis, you know, from Florida is pretty much the only guy that sticks out after Donald Trump. If you take Donald Trump's name away, Ron DeSantis is the leader. But he's got a problem because Donald Trump is not going to go quietly. I don't think he's going to become a senior diplomat who has nothing to say. He's always going to have something to say, and that makes it very hard for anybody else in the party who wants to run for president.
Cheney lost a lot of her luster because she was pushed out. And is it conceivable that she can gain a little more traction? Because she was like the renegade Republican.
Well, I
the anti-Trumper.
You know, there are a lot more people that are anti-Trump than were before because they're seeing that Trump actually was the reason that January 6th happened. They planned it in advance. They invited these people to the Capitol, and they told them to invade, the Capitol.
Yeah.
So if that's what they did, if that's what they planned, they have to be held responsible for it. And that's why Donald Trump now is starting to talk about prosecutors conducting witch hunts. But you know what? You could say that once, but you can't say that six times.
Right.
You know, if there's one prosecution, if the Russia thing was a witch hunt, you can't say it every time there's a prosecutor. You have to look at the facts. And if Donald Trump is indicted in multiple jurisdictions for multiple felonies, he's not going to be able to run.
Exactly. Wow. Well, very interesting. Well, there's so much more on the plate. Evidently, this was very interesting. The National Transportation Safety Board chairperson, a woman by the name of Jennifer Homendy, she was quoted in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette that Friday's collapse of the Fern Hollow Bridge in Pittsburgh should serve as a call to action. Is the federal government under President Biden, are they trying to focus on infrastructure? Because infrastructure is definitely deteriorating for many years. It's not just on his watch. It's only been there, a year and a half or 2 years? Only a year. So the thing is, can the federal government focus more attention? It also would employ more people. Is that an intent, or is that on the back burner?
They passed a $1 trillion infrastructure bill.
Yeah.
How much more focus can they possibly be on the issue?
I don't know. I don't know. That's
it's $1 trillion.
I can't even imagine what a trillion is.
Well, a trillion's a lot of money, right? So,
yeah.
You know, it's $1,000 billion, all right? Well, so the fact of the matter is that the collapse of the bridge is just symptomatic of what's going on all over the nation, where
mm-hmm.
we have neglected roads, tunnels, bridges.
Right.
We neglected LaGuardia Airport for now. They finally opened up a brand new terminal, which is state of the
mm-hmm.
art. But until recently, it was a third world airport. You could go to Costa Rica and get a better airport than LaGuardia.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But $1 trillion is being focused on repairing, rebuilding our infrastructure. And, you know, that's something that I think Joe Biden should be smacking his breast about all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something the Republicans can't really say much about. Even if they voted against it, they're bragging. They have bragging rights when they get home to their own constituencies, because this
right.
is something you can see. People can see this happening. You know, if you build a bridge or fix a road. So it takes time, though, Hezzy. It's not anything that happens in 30 seconds.
No, I agree. I agree. Do you think, though, that the White House is going to be a little bit we'll be just a little bit more loquacious about this effort and the $1 trillion investment in infrastructure? Because, you know, if you don't hear about it, you know, then you don't even know what's happening. It's like still quiet. It's so sublime.
Well, you know, if it was Donald Trump, he'd be out there screaming and yelling what a fabulous president he was. And I think
right.
a little more of that would help the Democrats bring a attention to the bills that they passed that are helping people, including the infrastructure bill, but also the COVID health bill that passed that gave everybody money that they apparently have saved. And now they're, you know, looking around to spend it, and inflation has made everything more expensive. Now, I wouldn't blame Joe Biden for that, but when the Federal Reserve makes money easy for 4 or 5 years, that's what you get. You get more money chasing fewer goods, and that pushes the price up. So, you know,
unbelievable.
The price of used cars has gone up by a third.
Yeah, it's amazing, amazing what's happening there. Oh, God. Well, there's something else that's very interesting. Axios, a writer there, Andrew Solander, reported that Nancy Pelosi is going to run for an 18th full term. And, you know, the suggestion is that the Republican effort to win the House has added a new angle to the Republican effort to win back the House. Is she that much of a lightning rod? Will that happen?
Let's go back to 2020. She was she was featured in Republican ads then.
Yeah.
Let's go back to 2018, not 2020. She was featured in Republican ads then, and the Democrats still did very well. So Nancy Pelosi is going to run again. Why would she say she's not and become a lame duck automatically?
That makes no sense. No.
Yeah, so, yeah, she says she's running for another term, and we'll see whether or not she does. But in the meantime, almost 10 months in advance, you know,
that's all right. Take your time.
No, I'm here. My wife's having a problem with our dog. The dog's neurotic a little bit.
Well, aren't we
He's
all?
He's a good dog, but he barks. Anytime a garbage person goes by to pick up the garbage in front of the house, he goes nuts.
Oh, wow.
No, he really is
He's
a great watchdog, you know.
But
when you tell him to shut up, he doesn't shut up. I'm good.
Oh, he doesn't do that? Sounds like a lot of people I know.
Exactly.
But not so good with the garbage man. So you got a lot going on there, which is cool. So why has she become a lightning rod? Is it because she's so powerful? she's able to really to deliver. She's been doing it for years. It's amazing how she's been able to manage government.
She's a liberal from San Francisco.
Hmm.
Right? That makes that puts a target on her back right there.
We hold that much animosity towards people who are so good at what they do. Does it matter that she's from San Francisco? She could be from Illinois for all we know. I mean,
she's good at what she does. She's a liberal from the coast, and that's what all these right-wing media outlets single out. If you're from the coast, you're not American. You're anti-American. Meanwhile, the people that are traitors and anti-American are those people that attacked the democracy on January 6th and their supporters, people that are anti-democratic and anti-American.
Mm. Unbelievable. How does it look like? Can we tell yet, as a pundit, can you suggest where we're heading as a nation? With all these things happening, the unraveling of what's going on with Trump, and so we're gonna learn a lot of facts about him. There's talk of Hillary Clinton coming back into the field.
That's nonsense.
She might run for president.
She's not running.
I can't imagine, but I don't know why they even brought her up. But there's nobody out there at the moment. I guess nobody wants to get ahead of Biden, even if he may or may not run. Or even Kamala Harris. I don't know if she's going to be able to run. Do we know what's happening 3 years down the road?
No, of course not.
No, that's what I figured. I couldn't
tell.
No,
but the signs are that Joe Biden's going to be 82 in 2024. He should not run. An 82-year-old should not run for president of the United States. So he is not going to announce that now. Okay, but then the question is, does Kamala Harris step into the void? And the answer is, there's probably not going to be Democrats running to her defense, because so far she's been a bit of a disaster. And I think what they'll do is have a series of primaries, just like when Joe Biden ran for president. Nobody anointed him the nominee. He had a run, and he lost. He lost badly in the first three or four primaries. He went to South Carolina, and he won, and that was the end of that. So they're going to have another series of primaries, which probably very healthy, by the way.
Yeah,
and while the Republicans are in a quandary, because if you talk to them privately, they do not want Donald Trump to be the nominee. He lost three times.
Yeah.
He lost the House. He lost the Senate in Georgia presidency. Mm-hmm. He lost three times, and they don't want him running again. So for the Republicans, the question is, who steps out and challenges Donald Trump and who, you know, without pissing off his base? See, if Trump says, I don't want you, you're a rhino, and he goes out to these rallies, then whoever the Republicans pick and can't win the election, right? And here's the other kicker. If Donald Trump runs, if he's dumb enough to run, Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney, either together, separately, will run a third-party ticket in swing states that will take votes away from Donald Trump by attracting traditional Republicans.
Mm. Wow, that could be that would be a third party, my God, but that could be very powerful. And why is it that there's so much speculation? Go ahead.
No, I said they only have to get on the ballot in the states that are marginal. They don't have to get on the ballot in all the states to make Trump a loser. All they have to do is qualify in Georgia, Arizona, you know, Pennsylvania, you know the states. And if they're on the ballot there and they run a traditional Republican race, Republicans will vote for them. And that will deprive Donald Trump of the ability to win those swing states and the presidency. So I don't think he's going to run. Because I don't think he wants to be tarred with a name loser. If you run once and lose, it's one thing. If you run twice, you're Adlai Stevenson.
Right. And why is it that there's so much speculation, or maybe it's just talk, which is foundless, that the Republicans could conceivably tilt the political scale? And a lot of local campaigns, Republicans are getting a little bit more credibility, and even on the national stage. Is that just speculation, or is that just like hype in order to build up a name?
No. What the Republicans are doing, what the right wing of the party is doing, is starting at the ground level, at boards of education level, local council elections, and they're going to try to tilt the election by stealing it. Because if they put their people in sensitive places, they can then pass these laws, which are draconian, which prevent minorities from accessing the polls. So if you're standing in line for 3 hours in Georgia and it's illegal to give you a glass of water, okay, and you're black, that disadvantages you in terms of accessing your franchise. And that's what they're trying to do.
Absolutely.
And they're trying to do it all over the nation in these states that are swing states. So what they want to make it, they want to make it tougher for minorities to get to the polls. That's the goal, so that they can declare an election, you know, a do-over if Trump loses. So, but that's what we have to
And is this really, all of this was initiated and came about under the Trump era? Is this what he was able to create in his 4 years? I mean, is this the attitude that somehow infused America to such a great extent? Because to be honest with you, I'm in no condition to be waiting 3 or 4 hours to get to the polling booth. It would be insane even in my condition to do that. To me, if, I'm thrilled to pieces that I could mail it in. I have a legitimate reason why I would mail it in, as opposed to being there. Is this what's happening now?
If you request an absentee ballot, that should not be a problem. I don't think any state is trying to ban absentee voting. What they're trying to ban is universal mail-in voting, where everybody gets a ballot sent to them, and they can choose whether or not to go physically or to send it in. But if you request an absentee ballot, that's a different situation.
I did request.
Yeah. That will still be fine.
So that's the real difference. And why should it be so difficult then for everybody to get it?
That's right. They're trying to stop universal mail-in voting, where everybody gets a ballot, and people that are dead get ballot. They're saying, you know, people that are crippled, people that don't deserve a ballot are getting a ballot. That's what they're trying to stop, even though there was no evidence of fraud anywhere sufficient to overturn the election. And that was stated by Arizona, by Georgia, which hand-counted the votes 3 times, and other states.
You know what I could never understand is how could anybody who's dead come and vote? Would they do it telepathically? I mean, how is this done?
No. The ballot of a dead person is voted by somebody else.
Right.
That's when they say,
they didn't actually vote.
Yeah,
no, I understand that. So it's conceivable that, a ballot can come to somebody's residence, even though they may be unrelated, and they could just tick off. I got you. That's how it works. Okay.
Or somebody can go in and get the election roll and go see who's alive and who's dead. And if they're dead, get a ballot in their name and mail it in. That's all possible, but none of it happened. But none of it happened anywhere.
I know.
And by the way, the only instances of it happening were by Republicans.
That's very interesting. Very, very interesting. Well, on that note, you keep us, with bated breath. We'll have to wait till next week for more. Thank you very much, as always. What a pleasure.
I'll speak to you next week.
Very much, Michael Edelman. All the best. Bye. All right, let's bring in none other than Ron Matten, the man of the hour. Not only is he the man of the hour, but he's also, it was written up, of all places, in the Wall Street Journal. So how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you very well. You sound great. Better than ever. Maybe it's that bounce from being written up in the Wall Street Journal. I don't know. It's like something in your voice.
Well, thank you. I wasn't written up, but I guess the Wall Street Journal did pick up our issues we're having in Yonkers with the Community Choice Aggregation Program.
Absolutely.
Although it wasn't on our topic list, it is timely because it was picked up in a national publication.
Absolutely.
And I do contend, well, again, I'm not against opting into green energy. I do contend that the city did it in such a way which does not meet the guidance or spirit of the Public Service Commission, where the envelope was and letter was required to have a City of Yonkers letterhead, although the city seal was in the lower right-hand corner. It's generally mm-hmm. where you put your thumb when you pick this thing up. And if you consider the history of Yonkers recommending the water insurance plan, that was a similar envelope, which was an opt-in for $211 a year. You could protect your water lines. But that was not an opt-out. So a lot of people threw this away, partly because the guidelines weren't adhered to, and the education period for this was a year ago. So there's a 60-day mm-hmm. education period required prior to the opt-out date, and the city started that sometime February 2021, even before the mm-hmm. law had been passed. I don't think there was enough of a hoopla. We can do political mailings. When we want to call out our candidates, we can do robocalls, we can do text messages. All of these avenues should have been available to the city to get people on board well before, we're approaching the opt-out date 10 days from now.
Right, exactly.
I am calling on the council to extend the date, although considering the council meetings, I don't think that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not opposed to the rate. We're in a rising utility rate market right now. So if you can lock in your rate, it may not be a bad thing. I can't advocate one or the other because, I'm not an energy
advisor.
Your
rates fluctuate. Mm-hmm.
Right. I'm not an energy advisor. I can't tell you where we go. I'm just calling out the procedures which were used to implement this program. Were flawed.
Well, that's really the issue, isn't it? It passed. The issue came before the city council. City council approved it. There was very little notice given to it, certainly no press notice whatsoever to anybody. Not everybody has an opportunity to be listening for, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours to a city council meeting,
right.
Even if it's broadcast, live. And, people don't realize we all get up probably about 6 or 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning and go to work or begin work. And then you've got a meeting at 7 o'clock at night, and it can go on till 9 or even 10 o'clock at night. And it's hard to, just to cull all this information out there. And yet it was just covered up, which is, I guess, where it really went wrong. Because the opportunity to opt out should have been afforded rather than to sign everybody up collectively.
Right. Now,
which
the
really
public
is
service,
not a standard.
The Public Service Commission pushes the opt-out option, if you will. But the city could have done it either way. I suppose that the city was or Westchester Power was probably able to negotiate a better rate with the thought of over 200,000 signing in automatically than people being told. So the city, that was a better rate, more than likely was able to be negotiated. But again, it just takes away from people. You have seniors who are snowbirds who go to Florida, and so they're not checking their mailbox every day. And then you have some many people thought, all right, this is an offer for car insurance, for water protection, for any of those other things you get, and threw it away.
Mm-hmm.
The city council should have done a little bit of a traveling show, some town halls, stopped by the senior centers, set things up at the libraries, and there, you know, we can advertise this Generation Yonkers all over the place,
yeah.
Although I don't know exactly what that means. But we can advertise
Neither
Generation Yonkers, but we have billboards and everything up and spend money for that.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly could have thrown a few dollars to advertise that this program was coming, and it should have been done well back in November.
We would have done it for free, but I guess they don't think so hard because it's part of what should be. We should be able to reach out to the public.
Right, and I don't want to cast any dispersions. I don't know, you know, if it was in anyone's interest to. They were required.
I have no idea.
They were required to do an education 60 days prior to the opt-out.
Mm.
They did do that probably about
really?
300 days. Well, they did it 300 days prior to the opt-out date. So that 300, you know, nobody's going to remember a year from now, or a year ago rather, that
right.
they could have changed, you know, that this date's coming up because it was dropped.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more than likely dropped
yeah.
because the contract for the old supplier expired in November, and they didn't get
mm-hmm.
Constellation on board till January. So anyway,
mm-hmm.
we weren't exactly here to talk about that, but I guess because it was
no, we
topical.
Didn't plan on it.
Yeah, it was topical today because the Wall Street Journal
yeah.
picked it up and really did not put Yonkers in a good light in their commentary.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to start off by talking a little bit about the need to get your heart rate up. I'm not a physician. So any exercise
mm.
programs should be discussed with your physician before embarking. But, you know, we're in a cold winter, and a cold winter
yep.
that we're dealing with COVID restrictions, and people don't really
mm-hmm.
get out much. So I'm proposing there are 28 days in February, and we should be doing 28 minutes per day of some sort of activity, which just gets your heart rate up. It could be walking. It doesn't all have to be in the same 28 minutes. The longer you can do, the better. But
mm-hmm.
if you can only do 8 minutes and break it into 8 to 10 minute
right.
Groups, that's fine. Just to kind of keep moving so you get ready for spring. I'm doing it
mm-hmm.
mostly on a treadmill. You know, as I get older, my knees are getting deteriorated, and I don't run in the street anymore. So I'm on a treadmill. I'll do that for 28 minutes each and every day. One or two days in between the week, I'll pick walking so I don't beat myself up. But walking for 28
mm-hmm.
minutes is a lot better than sitting.
Yeah,
so I'm trying
absolutely.
I'm trying to get as many people on board for this 28 and 28 challenge. Again, please check with your physician. I'm not a doctor. Check with your physician before any taking on any unusual activity.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have cardiologists. All that needs to be taken into account. I'm just doing it because my dad had a couple of strokes and a couple of heart attacks. You know, a lot has to do with diet as well.
Yeah.
You got to watch those saturated fats. And article came out this morning that put bacon as the worst food you could possibly eat.
Really? I had no
even
idea.
Even turkey bacon.
So it's
turkey
right
bacon
kosher.
As well. Well,
uh-huh.
turkey bacon as well.
So turkey
I know
bacon?
Turkey bacon can be kosher, yeah. But it's the way the meat is processed.
Uh-huh. That's
so, yeah, I know many of my friends who keep kosher, they'll eat turkey bacon.
Because,
it's not treif.
Uh-huh.
Treif. Am I saying that correctly? Treif?
Yeah, treif. Treif, yeah. It means
treif.
It's not
kosher. Not treif.
Uh-huh.
But it's also processed
it's
in such
processing.
A way.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's the processing, and I guess the sulfites or nitrites. It's the nitrites within the food can raise your blood pressure. And
wow.
So even turkey. But, you know, there's an old adage that says it's the dose that makes the poison.
Yeah, it's true.
So, you know, things in moderation, even a little bit of alcohol, coffee, processed meat, you take things in moderation and what your body can deal with. So it's the dose that creates the poison.
Absolutely.
So that's a little bit on the health. You know, so as even if you're just kind of moving your arms, moving around, hopefully you'll join and just being a little more active in the month of February because we're all locked in.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's funny because I haven't been out for a couple of days, so I was looking out there. It seems that the snow is being all pushed to the side, so it's being cleaned up. So I figured, I haven't even looked at the temperature yet, but I just want to get out. So
yeah,
I'll take a little walk.
It is a little chilly today. Be careful. Tomorrow we start raising the temperature. I think it's about 37, and by Thursday we have the possibility of getting up to 60.
You're kidding me.
No.
Oh, my God. So people have to be very careful not to step out at 60 because, my God, they'll catch a cold or who knows what.
So
your body's not ready for this sort of stuff. Ooh.
No, it's a little freaky week. I mean, it's going to rain. I heard it's supposed to rain on Thursdays as well. So
they'll wash all the snow away.
Yeah, we'll get
that'll
the snow away, and you know, just be careful with the ice out there.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
You know, things freeze up. I think we're just at about 30, 32 today. So. Still some good chance
not
for ice patches.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the other part of our agenda, which will be, the meat of today, will be the Yonkers Joint School Construction Board.
Oh, yeah, that's a very interesting thing. So what tell us about that.
So the Yonkers Joint
School.
Because
you're talking about the Dennis School.
Yeah, St. Dennis, the old St. Dennis School property. So the Yonkers Joint School Construction Board. This was legislation that was put together by Shelley Mayer, and it followed the Rochester and Buffalo legislation, which basically allows Yonkers to get double the reimbursement because some of our schools are in such bad shape, up to double the reimbursement in what we lay out to build new schools. We submitted a plan.
The property was bought, and there was an edifice there. There was a building. So
they
were going to knock the building down and rebuild?
Right, yeah. The property was purchased, I believe, for about $4 million. And some of my numbers may be fuzzy because I'm working on three.
Okay.
I've got my own construction projects at work. And then, you know, there are two
other boards.
Are the numbers important?
No,
the numbers aren't that important. So we purchased the property. We need to leave the church because there's a crypt underneath the church. And so the church will stay. There's the rectory, the school building, and I believe a small convent residence that was part of the purchase. And the St. Dennis School proper will be...
So the convent is still functional?
Everything is now owned by the city of Yonkers. And we'll be building what's known as a community school. I believe its designation for the time being is Community School 35. And that's the working designation. It may be renamed after somebody later on. But it's really a nice concept. The gym is separate from the school. I mean, they connect, but you're able to close off the gym so that if the neighborhood wants to use the gym after hours for events or neighborhood programs, it's available. There's also a health center. I believe the city has a contract with Montefiore to run health centers at schools. And there's a health center which will have a place for a pediatrician, also have a place for some dental services. And that can be separated from the school so that the community can use that health center. And that's really an area we probably need some community health. St. Joseph's.
Well, that's very interesting because it just actually catapults your concept of 28 in February. It's perfect.
Did
you plan all this, or
no?
I didn't.
The good
Lord decided to gift you with it.
This was so you know the Yonkers Joint School Construction Board is an entity set up by New York State. It is an entity with bonding authority. So these are not bonded through the city, but it's bonded. It's bonded through the committee. Yonkers IDA is responsible for the bonding, but all the authorizations are through this committee. The Board of Ed does not have any authorization over the committee, although Reverend Steve Lopez and Dr. Quesada do sit on the committee. It's a 9-member committee. The mayor is the chair. So there is a lot of input from the city. But it's an independent. It's independent of the school board and independent of the city. So
the entire cost is being borne by the state.
No. The state's reimbursing a substantial amount, up to 70%. And the city has bonded the entire project and will get reimbursements, which will retire some of the bonds. And
so it would retire about 70% of the cost of the bonds?
Of the cost of the
school, suggesting?
Yes. Yeah, so
can we afford the 30%? Because that was one of the biggest issues with the state, that when we needed to build, a school, we didn't have the capacity to pay for it.
Right, so these are
the state subsidy actually allows us to be able to pay it off.
Yeah, so we've bonded it through the IDA with revenue bonds. So the payments, a revenue bond is so a general obligation bond is borne by the city and the ability and the full faith and credit of the city and the ability of the city to pay it back just based on its balance sheets. A revenue bond is working with revenue coming into the city. In this case, it would be school aid that would be paying for this. So I believe the intergovernmental transfers from the state to the city will in part pay for this. Now, remember, these are other payments that that's guaranteeing the bond. At the end, the taxpayer is always going to make those payments because the revenue coming in from the state, we're still going to need money to run the schools. But it's just backed by that revenue. It's a revenue bond versus a general obligation bond.
So I understand there are about 600 kids that are expected to attend the school?
Yeah, the school is built for 600 kids, and it's really a good location because we don't have a lot of schools. I mean, School 13 is right up the block, that's true, but we don't have a lot of schools on the west side, and many of our schools are really in bad condition. KG&D is the architect that was hired by Yonkers Public Schools to do an assessment of all the schools. I'd say this probably took place back in 2015, somewhere around that. I was working in Greenwich at the time, and I had, through an open bid process, we also hired KG&D to put our master plan together, deciding what we needed to do.
What is it that they're required to do on a master plan for a school? Do they know what technology to put in there and how to define that structure so that it meets the needs of the student population,
especially with
internet service and stuff like that?
So, yeah, there were a couple of things that we put in our request for proposals. And one is we wanted a calculation of what our district would look like over the next 10 years. So that meant saying, okay, we have a little Greenwich. It's not no longer I don't work there anymore. But Greenwich has a little different model. They have community schools. So there's very little busing, except for the high school and middle schools. And the children in the elementary schools live within the catchment zones of certain mm-hmm. schools. So what we wanted to know was, what's our population going to look like over the next 10 years? We're going to have an increase in mm-hmm. population and a decrease in population. And there are companies that do that via model. So we commissioned that as part of it. So we knew what the schools should look like in certain areas. The other thing that we asked them to do was to evaluate
like what?
The schools.
Like what? What? You know, that's the problem. Quite often they say we're going to build, but they don't tell you what they're building.
Right.
I mean, is there any input from here, from other than all these professionals who just get paid and they just want the money? Because, you know, there a lot of the schools are just not conducive to our times.
Well, yeah, so there are changes in the way education happens. I mean, look at this pandemic. It's caused us to do this Zoom.
I know that, but the point is that does the administration understand that that's required? Or
which
are we just going to build something because it's off the shelf from 20 years ago?
Which administration
I mean,
are we speaking?
Are
we speaking
about
of the opposite?
This administration?
This administration.
Sure.
Yeah, so...
Well, because
we
doesn't this administration have to pass off on it, say, yeah, this is okay?
Right. So under New York state law, what they need to do is they need to mm-hmm. do a feasibility study, what's needed in the school
uh-huh.
before they present it for the law. So that wasn't part of the board's – that wasn't part of the Yonkers Joint School Construction Board's responsibility. That came from the Board
uh-huh.
of Ed. The Board of Ed needed to build a feasibility plan, and that's really –
Have they?
Meeting with, they had to in order to get this passed. So they needed to meet with educators, and they needed to decide what needs to be in the school and how it looks.
Can I ask you a question? It all sounds
sure.
wonderful. You know what? I feel like I want to go to that restaurant. It sounds so terrific. But God forbid I should open up the menu. I won't find what I need. And that's really the problem. Has anybody overseen any of this stuff? Not that I could tell you what you should do with a school. But hopefully the experts are there and they can validate their perspective. We're talking a fortune of money, and it better be good and well spent, not where we find out, oh, it's been built and we can't do anything about it anymore.
Yeah, well, these
I mean, this really matters.
And again, it's more self-compliance than it is it fully vetted. It's not
I don't know what that means.
So this State Education Department oversees the process, but again, it's educators overseeing educators, and so it's a bit of
that tells me absolutely nothing. It could be absolutely nothing. The people who are, you know, engaged have no clue what we're trying to do here in Yonkers. That doesn't mean they're ignorant in any way, but what are they lending to the equation? What are we lending to the equation? What are we doing about it? What about the internet service? How do you get all that stuff done? Are we going to have computers in every room so that every kid can do their work? You know, it's
well,
very nice. You're going to have stuff for the seniors, which is wonderful. But what about kids who may need to stay there because they don't have a computer or Wi-Fi at home? What do we
so
do about
that? That's part of the education plan.
Okay.
There is
so
another
when
New York...
When are we going to do that?
There is another New York State program that was passed in the last legislative session. I can't
mm-hmm.
speak to it because I haven't thoroughly read it.
Okay.
But I understand there were some set-asides for families. There was monies set aside for families
mm-hmm.
that could not afford internet service
mm-hmm.
that would provide a reimbursement for internet service. So I don't know exactly how the Board of Education at Yonkers is delivering that program.
Uh-huh.
I know what we did in Greenwich even prior to that was we got those little hockey pucks, we called them. Those were the MiFi
mm-hmm.
units
right.
that worked like your phone, and you would log on to them, and they provided the internet
right.
service. We did that for any family on free and reduced lunch.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
well, we have a lot of those types of students in our city.
We do. 78%. Of our population
right.
in the Yonkers schools are on free and reduced lunch. The inverse was
mm-hmm.
true in Greenwich. It was about 28% of
right.
the families were on free and reduced lunch. So it was a much lower
right.
bar to meet. So yeah, it's a high bar to meet here.
But it's not insurmountable. It is what it is.
Right.
And a lot of the companies that operate here, they understand the dynamics and the numbers and the percentages.
Well,
but they
want
to function. Since we give them a special franchise, they could do something in response, right?
Well, I've also
it's not hard to work out.
Right. Well, there's a new tax within the cell phone bill and the data bills and everything that is supposed to pay into this program that Yonkers can draw on. I've always thought that we should do some public-private partnerships as well. Why don't you know we could allow some namings of our gyms or our athletic fields or even some programs where larger companies like PepsiCo may want to contribute to a school program and allow them to take credit on their branding a little bit, so that if we could get a few $100,000 or $1 million through that program, it would defray some of the costs of bringing these schools.
We could also be magnanimous and say, hey, PepsiCo, thanks for giving us all the food that we distribute in the city for all the people who don't have means, and they give it to us. They don't get any credit for it, other than the label on a particular bottle or snack or food and stuff like that. You know, that would be terrific.
Yeah.
Couldn't hurt, even if
we did
it for a year.
Or even with our athletic programs. You know, we had to cut the athletic programs down so much because of funding. So if you got Spalding in here or Champion or any of these companies and give them some sort of credit and some branding. Look how quickly our community choice aggregation program went national. You know, think about the goodwill these companies have by coming in and doing some good for our students who are at or below the poverty level.
Absolutely. This is very exciting stuff, but we don't see that happening on the city side at the moment. So maybe that's something that needs to be a lot more. I know I've been talking about it for years, but it's like deaf ears. I just don't get it.
Your next guest has a background in education, as well as currently being our.
He's not going to be on today because
normally
supposed to be on Friday. And because that's his normal time slot, every Friday from 10 to 11. But this Friday, they were in session. Then I checked with him again yesterday, and he said they're going to be still in session today, tomorrow, and Wednesday. So he's not going to be on this week either. Maybe he'll be on at the end of the week. I've got a slot for him if you want.
Okay, you had
but,
a good...
I
had
don't
a
know
good,
if he can.
You did have a good topic for him.
Perfect. But we'll resurrect it for him when he shows up.
Okay.
He's also a wealth
of experience, having worked as an educator and having been president of the school board. So he can bring a lot of insight into best practices.
Absolutely. So that's
in fact,
always
he was
good.
He was a superintendent, I believe, at a charter school or a private school in Yonkers as well.
I didn't know.
Yeah, it's the Andalusia School.
The Andalusia School, yes.
Andalusian
right.
School,
100% right. Yeah, Andalusia School.
So he's got
absolutely.
A pretty hefty resume on education.
Yeah, absolutely, which is really terrific. Because the Andalusia School was a Muslim school, but he also speaks Arabic, which is terrific, and Spanish and English as well, which is really quite good. And then he was at the Yonkers Board of Education Board of Trustee President, no less.
Mm-hmm.
So and then he's a lawyer on top of that. My God, I don't
know
how much can you wear.
Well, I'm saying so he can really probably speak on the inner workings of the Board of Ed and how these feasibility programs are put together for the schools and how they develop or how they should develop. The way the school is laid out.
Yeah. So in a sense, really, the St. Denis School, even though it was purchased, I think about a year ago, or something to that effect, I don't know how many months ago, The process does take quite a long time. So have we paid the Archdiocese for the building, or
yeah,
are we waiting for the state to reimburse us?
No, the state will refund us or reimburse us based on our layout, on our outlays.
Okay.
So we've already purchased, Yonkers has already purchased the building. There was a asbestos abatement contractor hired to go in and remove the asbestos. And then there was a demolition contractor hired to start demo on the building.
Okay.
We met on Friday. And we voted on the construction manager and a few of the key trades, and that'll be coming out. We worked with the same actually construction manager. I'm not going to say who it was because the minutes have to be published and everything. But we worked with the same construction manager in Greenwich on the firehouse, and they did a very nice job on time and under budget.
I think you mentioned it before, but I'm not going to repeat it now. I remember the name. That's okay.
So we all unanimously voted for them. The demo contractor, which was awarded a while back, there were two no votes on them, and I was one of them. I just feel they didn't have the history for it.
I was wondering about our population. We have over 200,000, I think 210,000 officially population, but so many people, I understand, are moving into Yonkers. They're looking for a different place, more affordable. So people are coming into Yonkers, and therefore, you know, adults have children. And so is it conceivable that 600 is going to alleviate the strain on our student population and also our infrastructure with regard to education, or is that even not enough?
Well, it'll help. It'll help. And remember, we're on a program of building multiple schools. This is only the first school within this program. So, for instance, the Gorton School is in such bad shape that that building needs to be knocked down and a new building built. So we're also going to need swing space as we try to go through and get
What is that?
Well, it's where we can move students. It's where we can move students when we construct other schools or refurbish other schools.
I got you. Yeah, because that's
a
while.
We'll need to be able to swing in and out of some of these places. What's nice about putting schools on the west side of town is we don't have, you know, the buildings that are there are tend to be the older buildings.
Right.
So they need to be, they're in poor shape.
Oh, there's some properties there that can be demolished, and they're in such poor shape anyway, not even schools, but there's much more that you can build over there. And we haven't apportioned an equal number of students on the east and the west side. So there's a disparity there as well. And is that going to alleviate some of our costs as well with regard to busing? Because we're spending a fortune on busing.
Right. The last school budget I looked at was about 2 years ago, where I really got into the details. And I recall that we spent about $36 million on busing, but we were reimbursed by
10.
The state for about 10. I thought it was 33 million. I'll have
to look it up. I thought it was only 10 because I thought that our final figure was about 26 million. I could be wrong.
I'm sure you have
the information. I don't get it.
I need to look it up. But I know we spent 36.
Okay.
Even the reimbursements, it means they can reimburse us somewhere else. Look, I know that Senator Cousins has touted that this tremendous package is coming our way. Let's hope that we deserve it by spending it appropriately. And I'll be interested to see how the school budgets look, because again, people are moving to Yonkers. But if
let me just
I think
good schools, what?
I think you'd see you know, not just people moving to Yonkers, but taxpayers moving to Yonkers. People want to buy mm-hmm. homes in places that have good
right.
schools. People rent in places that don't.
Exactly. Well, let me just point out that we have a caller on the line. It's probably for you because it's not for me, because you're more compelling than I am. Let's see if we can pull them in. Good morning, caller. Would you just be kind to give us your first name so we can address you with respect? Do you have a question?
Hi, Hezzy. This is Nader Sayage. I've been listening to your discussion and enjoying the discussion. Wanted to make sure that I know we had a topic on redistricting today.
Yes, I just wasn't sure that you'd be able to call in because I know you're still at in session. So are you going to be able to talk to us?
Yeah, definitely.
Say that again?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
I'm on the way up to Albany, but I would be more than glad to join the discussions.
Well, I'm going to sit back and listen to redistricting because that's something I have no information on.
Well, neither do I.
I will be actively listening, and I appreciate the time, Hezzy. Assemblyman Sayage, it's always a pleasure hearing your broadcast.
Ron Matten, always a pleasure. Glad you continue to stay involved. And as Hezzy and I say repeatedly on the show, awareness and public awareness and knowledge is the greatest asset. So anytime we can converse, we can talk, we can look at the issues, the concern, it's a win-win for the public at large. So, Ron, thank you for being on the show and I was listening to the issue of busing and the issue of schools, and definitely very interesting, very much a concern for Yonkers.
Do you recall the grant that we get from the state on busing?
Well, you know, busing, for example, we get compensated. I'm not exactly sure the amount, but you brought up a good point with regards to the outlays, the debt services. You know, Hezzy knows we spoke about legislation we introduced my last session to really up the percentage that Yonkers gets whenever we renovate or build new schools. You know, a number of years ago when I was president of the Board of Ed, Yonkers was getting like 50 cents on a dollar for any costs we incurred in building or renovating schools. And over the last 5 years, we're able to bring it up to 70%. But then when you compare us to Buffalo and Rochester and Syracuse, and they're getting like 98 cents on a dollar,
right.
It doesn't cost them much to renovate and build new schools. So my legislation would hopefully put us on equal par with people like in Buffalo, where when you compare our percentages, our student population, we're not much different from them as far as our percentages. So, you know, that's part of my fight up in Albany to really make sure there's more equity in funding by changing the way the state funds educational and by also the way they fund rebuilding and renovation of old school buildings. And God knows, in Yonkers, the average school is now becoming nearly 100 years old. So when they talk about safety and ventilation, it's terrible. So, you know, I'm glad that you're having this discussion. It's very important.
Thank you. I'm gonna jump off now so I don't take up more of your time. But thank you, and I'll be listening.
Thanks a lot, Ron.
Thanks so much, Ron.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate it very much. Enjoy the day.
Thank you. You too.
Bye. Okay. Well, you know, Assemblymember Nader Sayage, what a pleasure to hear your voice today. So I'm sorry to have kept you on the line for so long. So what is going on with reapportionment, and how does that affect our demographic lines?
Well,
that's huge.
Definitely. Reapportionment, or better known as redistricting, takes place, as you know, has every 10 years. Every 10 years when we have a census, you know, America has a census every 10 years where we basically try to determine how many people live in each community, in each state, in each region of the country, and we try to utilize that data for a number of areas to determine how much federal aid goes to a community, to determine when we talk about representation, congressional and assembly and Senate. It becomes very important to have the census data so we can begin to what they call the drawing of new lines. So in New York State, this is the process that's taking place now. Last week and this week, we're looking to spend at least till Thursday in Albany, state members of the state assembly, the state senate, and we're looking at potentially new congressional lines. We're looking at new assembly lines, senatorial lines, and a lot of that is based on, you know, what has taken place the last 10 years. The last census we have is the 2020 census, and that's what will determine whether or not New York State, let's say, loses congressional seats. As you know, New York State in the 2010 census has the, because we lost population, we lost two congressional seats in 2010.
Yeah.
The 2020 census, many of us around the state worked very hard to try to maintain and not lose another congressional seat. And the sad part of it, sad part is that by less than 100 votes, 100 number of individuals, you know, we lost a congressional seat. We were fortunately it was one seat. Some people thought we would lose another two seats. We are presently at 27 congressional seats based on our population of nearly 20 million people that live in New York State. Mind you, 40 years ago, that population was a lot larger. So we've been continuously losing population out of New York State. We lost, as I said, two seats in the 2010 census. And the last census, the 2020, we lost one more seat. So we'll be going down from 27 congressional seats to 26. So when this reapportionment or redistricting is taking place, you know, they're looking at new maps because we need to abolish one congressional seat in New York State. And a lot of people feel that seat would come from upstate New York somewhere. And the chances are they'll probably be in a Republican area where, you know, the Republicans would probably lose two seats. Looking at the numbers in New York State, there's presently eight Republicans in the New York State congressional districts. And the reapportionment is such where there's a possibility that the Republicans may lose 3 to 4 seats. Now, very often, when you talk about reapportionment or you talk about the redistricting, you know, it's a big debate because people get very concerned about, you know, when one political party controls the discussions or the way they set up the map. You know, people feel that the concept of gerrymandering takes place, and that means, you know, that one political party that may control the state can dictate lines that takes away from one political party and gives it to another so that the other party gets an advantage when it comes to election time. New York State is a heavily a Democrat state, so what Republicans may be complaining about in New York State is that the New York State legislative body that is presently in the process of determining the lines may do so at a disadvantage to Republicans. Mind you, in many states across the country, this is going on all over the USA. And in states where the Republicans control the bulk of the legislation, they may be doing the same thing, given a disadvantage to Democrats and an advantage to Republicans.
Do you think that people don't realize that if the Democrats control a particular section, that they will be favorable to Democrats, and then Republicans would be favorable to Republican candidates when they reapportion? Is that so difficult for people to recognize, or why is it so difficult? It seems like a standard thing.
Well, you know, some people may feel that if you have, for example, a Republican congressional representative that represents, let's say, a certain area of Long Island or state New York, or an area where presently the population is such where a Republican has a decent chance of winning. And let's say, for example, in this redistricting, a Democrat-controlled legislative body may turn around and say, well, you know, we don't like the way the lines were picked 10 years ago, and therefore we're going to revise it in a way where there's now a shift of population where, let's say, for example, if you have a Republican in a district where 55-60% of the voters are Republicans, and then by the way you shift the district, you bring that 55-60% down to 40%, right? They may feel, hey, you did this on purpose to give an advantage to a, let's say, now a heavily Democrat-registered population that would most likely vote for a Democrat.
I've got to ask you a question then. Is it possible that isn't there always a section of the state when it gets redistricted? It's never 50-50, is it? Can it even be 50-50?
Well, the chances are you go to some areas, like you go to New York City, you go to the Bronx, for example, where 80% of the population, for example, is black and Latino, you're going to have predominantly heavily leaning Democrat districts with heavy populations. And, you know, the chance of a Republican, for example, winning there is practically slim. But then you go to districts like in Westchester County, and New York, for example, these are areas where you'll find a pretty decent mixture. So, you know, in my opinion, these are districts where candidates from both political parties really have an opportunity to win. And if they base, let's say, their campaigns on issues and on concerns that impact that community, that region of the state, the chances are you can have an elected representative who's Republican or Democrat, you know, because in my opinion, there's always like 20 to 30% of people that vote that can lean either way. So even if somebody may be registered a Democrat or Republican, they may say, well, you know what, we're down the middle, we're moderate, and we're looking for the best candidate. We don't care what
you know what they say. You know they say in Yonkers, we're a little bit of country and a little bit of rock and roll. And there are certain sections in the districts of Yonkers where you could say, well, it seems like it's pretty balanced out between Republicans and Democrats, Democrats or Republicans, no matter how you want to look at it. And which makes it really very interesting. Is it conceivable that even a city like Yonkers, third largest city in the state, could that be reapportioned? Or maybe another part of Westchester County?
Well, Yonkers, for example, as you said, is, in my opinion, pretty diversified. As you said,
Yonkers,
for example, and we've seen over the last number of election cycles where in similar districts in East Yonkers, North Yonkers, where a Democrat can win or a Republican can win. And it seems
Absolutely.
To me that candidates that work harder, candidates that put themselves out there to the voters, really can develop an advantage, you know. And it doesn't matter if the the percentage of voters may be down the line 50-50, or in some cases, even in areas where you may have 55% Republicans, a Democrat can win, or 55% are registered Democrats, a Republican can win.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the goal of the legislative bodies in New York State, across the nation, is honestly to try to be as fair as possible. You know, the important thing is you don't want communities to be separated or disenfranchised. For example, in talking to many of my colleagues in the assembly, you know, you realize that many that represent different communities really are concerned about how these lines are drawn. For example, there's certain communities in New York City and Long Island that have a very high Asian population, and they may complain and say, well, if there's a certain part of Long Island or New York City that has a pretty decent 40% or more Asian population, when you split that up, you're taking away a potential seat from, let's say, the Asian community or communities
uh-huh.
that have similar concerns. A lot of African Americans are, you know, concerned that seats that were predominantly African American, you know, because of the way the shifts are taking place in lines and districts, you know, are now potentially, you know, not an African American seat where an African American can have a difficult time getting elected. But having said that, you know, you also
mm-hmm.
have population shifts in the state where now New York State is losing its African American population. Many are moving out. Many are saying, why are they moving out? What's wrong with the system in New York that we're losing
mm-hmm.
our African American population? We know that there's
bear
a
with me,
growing...
Bear with me one moment. Bear with me one moment, because we've got a caller probably wants to ask you a question or make a statement, and then we'll be... So bear with me a moment as I pull them in.
Sure.
Good morning, caller. Do you have a question or a statement to make, and would you be kind to give us your first name?
Yes, my name is Mike. Thank you for taking my call.
Your name is Michael, you said?
Yep, yes.
Okay, would you speak a little louder, please?
Yeah, sorry about that. I apologize. No, I just wanted to talk about the issue with the vaccine mandates that are still in place, like in New York City and other cities. And I'm just trying to understand what is the logic now behind that, seeing that now we understand that people who are fully vaccinated can still get COVID and pass it to other people. And now that that's an established fact, wasn't that the entire rationale?
I understand your question, but the assembly member is not discussing that. We're talking about school reapportionment and reallocation of congressional and assembly lines. So if you want to, I don't know, today's just not the day for it, unfortunately, because we got to finish what he's talking about. So I'm sorry you're not on topic. Thanks for calling, though. Bye. Okay, sorry about that, Nader.
No problem. Well, you know, later on, if there's an opportunity, we can always make a statement with regards to vaccination. I know the listening audience always have a lot of issues and concerns, and we, you know, we appreciate that. But right now, the biggest issue in New York State and really across the nation is the redistricting process, and that's why this topic is really extremely important, and many people really don't understand. And I think, you know, for you, Hezzy, to make this a topic of discussion really is not only timely, it's very crucial. And people need to recognize that, you know, when they look at, you know, who was their assemblyman, who was their state senator, and who was their congressman, it doesn't mean that every time they do redistricting, it's the same players or the same representatives. That's why
mm-hmm.
the public needs to understand. For example, if you look at the congressional seats, you realize that, you know, with the new plan before the legislative body, for example, Yonkers and our region of Westchester County largely is part of what they call Congressional District 16. Mind you, there's presently 27 congressional districts in New York State. When they usually plan to do the lines every decade, every redistricting, they start with the southern tip of Suffolk County, and they usually try to keep around 800 to 850,000 people in each congressional district. So they start drawing the map that starts from the southern tip of New York State till they go up to the Canadian border, to western New York, and so forth. Now, the 16th congressional district that was is presently half in the Bronx and half in Westchester County, with the proposed new lines, that is changing dramatically, where the 16th congressional district that's presently held by Congressman Jamal Bowman may end up being a small part of the Bronx and practically a bigger bulk of Westchester County, going all the way up into Putnam County. That includes Putnam Valley, Carmel, and Upper Westchester. So the social demographics are going to change dramatically for the 16th congressional district. This is something that, you know, is an example of how a lot of people may now realize that assuming the legislative body this week passes the congressional new line, they pass assembly and senatorial lines, they're signed by the governor, and then, you know, it opens up a whole new process where a lot of individuals or members of the opposite political party may determine that the lines are so unfair that they may bring legal action, as happened 10 years ago, where, you know, federal judges get involved and they begin the process of, you know, overturning what legislative bodies have done. So, you know, it's the long process. It's an interesting process. And it's really how it's an important component of how government runs here in America, you know, and how the process of line and who represents who takes place.
Sounds like you're going to need a couple of aspirins, you know, going through this process. My God, I would get a headache just even thinking about it.
And then last week when we were in Albany, you know, I was concerned because, you know, so many of my colleagues, for example, we're having serious discussions about the percentages of how many, you know, on race, on ethnicity, the percentages of African-American voters, the Latino voters, Asian-American, white voters. And at some point, I realized that, you know, what happened to the realization that one of the major components should be, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, is how many people are registered in your party? How many people are registered Democrats? And the reason for my statement to that effect was to tell my colleagues that, yes, race and ethnicity is important, of course, when you're looking at bases of support, but don't lose track of the importance of members of your party. Because when we look at a community like Westchester, Rockland, you know, what I consider still predominantly white areas, we have two African-American congressional representatives, which to my point shows that people, you know, do take into consideration ethnic and race as factors, but to a large extent, you know, party politics, whether Democrats vote as a bloc or Republicans, and also the issues that confront regions of the state. You know, just to send a message that don't lose track of an importance, for example, when you look at the makeup of your district, if that's what determines if you vote for changes in a plan or not, you know, what percentage is, for example, for Democrats are Democrats. And I look at that. When I look at the 90th Assembly District, this is the district I represent, for example. Fortunately, it's still predominantly in Yonkers. So the 90th Assembly District, my district, even with the new proposed lines, is predominantly in Yonkers, New York. And, you know, we
That's a godsend. Unfortunately, you got to forgive me, Assembly member. I said it's a godsend, but it looks like we're going to get disconnected automatically. So I look forward to speaking to you next week or Friday, whatever works.
Well, thank you very much, Hezi. Right. We'll talk more about redistricting, and we'll talk about other issues. Thank you very much,
Hezi. Be well.
Hezi.
Thank you so much. All the best. Speak to you tomorrow, folks. Be well. Goodbye.